feelings and calculations yourself. I'm a bit worried that I never get anybody to ask me how that's done. I mean, either you find it too, I mean, there's only one student among you who keeps asking me questions, and the others all just seem to be doing fine. If you are doing just fine, that's fine. But if you have questions, please do ask me. And even though I don't have regular office hours, I can always arrange for office hours. Not a problem. Just let me know. OK, so let us start then. Remember, our goal now is to solve the quantized Klein-Gordon equation on Friedman, Roberts, and Walker spacetimes. And we will therefore go through the same motions as we did in the past lectures, where we did it in full generality. But now we will do it specifically for the Friedman, Roberts, and Walker spacetime. So you will recognize that we do pretty much the same thing as what we've done before, except it's much more concrete now because we applied to particular space-time background. Remember, we established already that we obtain the solution to our problem, namely the time and space-dependent operator-valued field, through this answer. Some mode functions, times, creation, and annihilation operators. If we assume that the A and A dagger obey the usual commutation relations, and if we manage to find classical, that is, number valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, such that they obey this equation here. Remember, this equation we showed is really a resolution of the identity in the function space or in the solution space. And the reason why it has to hold is that we need the phi and the pi to obey the canonical commutation relations. So if you take phi with this ansatz, and then its derivative, that is to say pi, require that the phi-pi commutation relations hold, then you find that the phi pi commutation relations imply for the mode functions this equation here. This is the right hand side of the commutation relations here. Okay, so for the purpose of this lecture, we will call this equation C for commutation relations. So let's assume we succeeded. Let's assume we found a set of mode functions such that this identity holds, and therefore we have that phi hat solves the Klein-Gordon equation, solves the commutation relations, and it also is a Hermitian operator valued field. So assume we've done that. Later we will do this concretely, of course. Well, then we can use those A and A dagger operators here to build a convenient basis in the Hilbert space. Well, maybe I'm saying too much when I say convenient, because we don't know yet where it's going to be convenient. But we can build a basis in the Hilbert space. Namely, we identify that vector which is annihilated by all of the AK operators. And then from that vector, we can construct a lot of other vectors that are orthogonal to it and normalize themselves. Namely, for example, if you apply any one of those A dagger operators on this vector, we get a normalized vector. And we can also apply powers of them. We can apply several different of the A dagger operators on this vector 0. And each time we get another vector in our Hilbert space on which the phi hat is acting. And we can arrange for all those vectors to be normalized. So they will form an orthonormal basis. Remember that, strictly speaking, we are assuming here that our quantum field theory can be truncated by infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs so that there are only finitely many of those k. Otherwise, there are some subtleties. And one can argue whether they are more than subtleties or not. But for the moment, for practical purposes in cosmology, we can get away with this assumption that infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs can be imposed without changing the qualitative features of the theory. So we can make it still arbitrarily precise by just making the infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs arbitrarily far removed. So the statement was that if we find such mode functions, then we can build the basis of such vectors here. On the other hand, we already know on general grounds that if we find such a solution, if we find such mode functions, they're not going to be unique. There's going to be many such solutions. And if we come up with another solution to our problem, so if we find another set of mode functions, then that will be fine too. We get the same solution, phi hat of x and t, but now it's going to be expressed in terms of other mode functions, other a and a dagger operators, and so on. We know, because we implemented infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs, that we get the same function here because of the Stone von Neumann theorem. It's going to be the same solution. However, if we now use those tilde operators to build a basis of vectors in our Hilbert space on which the phi and pi act, then they're going to be a different set of vectors. The zero tilde vector that is annihilated by the a tilde has no reason to be the same vector as the zero vector that we looked at in the slide before, and so on. So which mode solutions should we choose? And therefore, which bases in the Hilbert space should we choose? This is going to be keeping us busy for quite a while to make that choice. Now, in order to actually get at those mode functions, any of those mode functions, we reformulated the problem a little bit. You see, when we formulate it in this way, then the mode functions have to obey the Klein-Gordon equation. They have to be complex number valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, so that this thing can be an operator-valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. But it turned out that the Klein-Gordon equation for those mode functions contained a friction term, contained a term proportional to the derivative. That is not nice. Ordinary harmonic oscillators and ordinarily fields on Minkowski space, for example, have second time derivatives, and they have terms without time derivatives. But the first time derivative indicates a friction term. And friction is something dissipative. In order to properly describe that, we should couple the system to another system to see how energy dissipates and so on. We can avoid all of those things by a simple trick. Namely, we simply change variables. Instead of working with the variable phi hat, let us work with the variable chi hat. It's also an operator valued field, also self-adjoint. The only difference between the chi hat and the phi hat is that chi hat is the phi hat multiplied with the scale factor. Remember, A is the scale factor, eta is the time. It is the conformal time variable, which is just a function of the, it's a function of the wristwatch time. Yes, please?
We do this just for mathematical convenience.
This definition here?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, we do that because if we now express the Klein-Gordon equation for the chi hat variable, then we find that it takes this form, and that form doesn't contain first derivatives, first time derivatives anymore. Only second time derivative and all the other terms don't have time derivatives. Therefore, this equation of motion looks much more similar to that of an ordinary harmonic oscillator. However, it is still a bit messy because it is a partial differential equation. It's not like an ordinary harmonic oscillator. An ordinary harmonic oscillator would have the second time derivative, and then it would have something multiplying the degree of freedom itself. That's fine, but we still have these space derivatives too. That makes it a partial differential equation. An ordinary harmonic oscillator is described by an ordinary differential equation. It has only one kind of derivative. Let's say time derivatives. This has time and space derivatives. Not a problem, though, because everything is linear in this business. So we can do a Fourier transform. We can do a Fourier transform with respect to the spatial variables now. So let us leave the time variable invariant. It just stays the same, spectator. And we do a Fourier transform of the chi field with respect to x. If we do this, then the spatial derivatives that are in the Laplacian become multiplication operators. Remember that under Fourier transform, multiplication becomes differentiation, or I times differentiation, and I times differentiation becomes multiplication with independent variables. So the derivatives d by dxi that are contained in this Laplacian become multiplication operators I times ki under spatial Fourier transform. So that means this suggests to use the usual trick for handling this type of partial differential equation. We do a Fourier transform so that these derivatives become multiplications with the Fourier partner variable k. In this way, we will have only time derivatives and no other derivatives. So it will become a set of ordinary differential equations. We also say that what we do here is to decouple the equation of motion. This is describing an infinite set of harmonic oscillators that are coupled because their derivatives, space derivatives. You see that there's, for every x, there's a harmonic oscillator. However, the harmonic oscillator at x sees and interacts with the harmonic oscillator at the neighboring x because of this derivative term here. Because of this derivative term here. So we say that these are coupled harmonic oscillators in position space. Now, when we do the Fourier transform, we will end up with independent harmonic oscillators. For every value k, the Fourier transform variable, we will have an independent harmonic oscillator. Here's how this goes. We start with the variable chi hat, which, remember, is simply a times phi hat. And we do the Fourier transform. This is the usual formula for the Fourier transform. And we obtain chi hat k of eta. In practice, if you think, you can think of chi hat as being a matrix. An infinite by infinite matrix, or if we implement infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs, then if you choose a suitable basis, this thing will be a matrix valued function of time and space. And so what you see here is that this is a Fourier transform of every individual component of that matrix. So it's a completely concrete thing. Don't be worried, don't be afraid that this is an operator that we're Fourier transforming, because you can always choose a basis in which each in which this operator is really matrix valued, and each component of that matrix is being Fourier transformed here. Of course, we will not worry about subtleties that may come about regarding the question whether it really is one is really allowed to choose bases and then Fourier transform, or Fourier transform and then choose bases arbitrarily. It could be that those two procedures don't interchange, but they do. So yep.
Working in infrared cuffs, right?
Yes, we are not actually putting them in there,
okay.
But I'm claiming that for the purpose of inflationary cosmology, we can always get away with doing them.
Okay.
And therefore, there are a lot of subtleties that otherwise would occur. We don't have to worry about it. Because in principle, we don't actually have to, see, we only have a finite number of those k values. Now, as you pointed out, we're not actually putting it in the infrared and ultraviolet cutoff, and that's because it's convenient. So I'm writing the inverse Fourier transform in this way. Remember that the forward Fourier transform has a minus sign here, the backward Fourier transform has a plus sign here. That's the inverse. If we really put in an, let's say, an infrared cutoff, then we would only have a discrete set of k's, and that would be a sum. This would still be an integral because space is continuous, but the reverse would be a sum, and then we would have to put in the sides of the box and so on. We've had that in the very early lectures of this course. We do the same thing for the canonically conjugate momentum field. This is the Fourier transform of the canonically conjugate momentum field. Remember that the canonically conjugate momentum field to pi has a superscript pi, because it's canonically conjugate momentum to pi, to chi, and not to the original field phi. We discussed the difference last time. So now, after the Fourier transform, the Klein-Gordon equation becomes this equation, which is exactly what we had before, except that where the Laplacian was, we now have, or minus the Laplacian was, we now have a plus k squared. Other than that, it's just the same. And you see, now we've succeeded in decoupling the equations of motion, because now we have for every value of k a harmonic oscillator, and the harmonic oscillator for k is not coupled or in any way interacting with the harmonic oscillator for a different k, because there's no k derivative in this. And there's no other k prime in this business. It's just one equation for each k. So in every point in momentum space, we have an independent harmonic oscillator, whereas at every point in position space, we had a harmonic oscillator, but it was coupled to the neighboring harmonic oscillator, which physically is very intuitive. If you have a field and you excite it at one point in position space, then this excitation is going to spread. You have a wave propagating. So you excited only one harmonic oscillator, perhaps, but it is going to excite all others. In momentum space, it's not like that. If you excite a harmonic oscillator in momentum space, it means that you excite a wave that is having a fixed wavelength, and it's just going to do its thing. It's just going to oscillate. But it's not going to excite the smaller wavelength oscillators or the larger wavelength oscillators. Not in Minkowski space, anyway. Now, here we work on expanding spacetimes. And remember that a few lectures ago, we said that if we just do a plain Fourier transform, we are not actually succeeding in decoupling the differential equation. And that's because when spacetime is expanding, then if you excite a mode in momentum space, so you're exciting a harmonic oscillator that corresponds to a point in momentum space, it means that you're creating a wave of a particular wavelength. In Minkowski space, it would stay that. It wouldn't excite longer or shorter wavelength oscillators. But in expanding spacetime, that's not so. The wavelength would actually expand along with the spacetime, which means that the original wavelength oscillator becomes de-excited, and the longer wavelength oscillator becomes excited. That is why we introduced the co-moving coordinate system, with respect to which distances stay numerically the same if they co-move with the expansion of the universe. So indeed, in this, using those co-moving coordinates, we obtained the Klein-Gordon equation that we just had two slides above. And the Fourier transform gives us this Klein-Gordon equation. And indeed, you see, it is decoupled, as we just discussed. And that means that we have now, for every co-moving mode, an independent harmonic oscillator. So you are exciting at one point in time, let's say, the harmonic oscillator for a particular wavelength, let's say 5 meters or so. Then over time, this particular mode will be a mode for 6 meters wavelength, and then it will be a mode for 7 meter wavelength, because the universe is expanding. And it keeps its excitation. And it will not excite the other modes, the smaller or the larger one. All right, so what we have is a Fourier mode for every k. Keep in mind that these are co-moving momenta. And they will just oscillate like an ordinary harmonic oscillator, where this piece here is the frequency of the harmonic oscillator. So overall, this equation of motion looks like that, where omega squared is this bracket here. Now notice that the frequency of such a co-moving mode can be imaginary, right? Because this thing might just dominate over that. And we'll have to see what that means. I think I gave you some intuition about it already, but we will soon see what it really means. So the omega k can become imaginary, namely if a double prime is large enough. Right, here we go. What could make it negative is if a double prime is large enough. What that means is that for this phenomenon to occur, we have to look for situations in which the space-time is accelerating tremendously. Ordinarily, one would say, well, it just has to be expanding like hell. It has to be inflating. Keep in mind that, strictly speaking, that's not so, because this could be also a deceleration. Not that it is cosmologically considered to be the case, but just as a possibility, it could occur. Another thing that is important here to notice in this with this frequency for these harmonic oscillators is that it's not only A double prime over A that matters in the question whether this drags everything into negative territory so that the frequency would become imaginary. What also matters is, well, the value of the scale factor, of course, but also what K is, what the co-moving momentum is. You see, let's say you have a mode of low co-moving momentum, which means long wavelengths. For given A double prime over A, this might be negative. But then if you look at the same time at a mode of much shorter wavelengths, much larger K squared, then this might still be positive. So that means that while the universe is expanding, and expanding in an accelerated fashion, we should expect that while that low K modes, the large wavelength modes, are more susceptible to this phenomenon that kicks in than short wavelength modes. Short wavelength modes, large K modes, tend to keep this positive and therefore behave as ordinarily on Minkowski space much longer than would much more likely to short wavelength modes are more likely to exhibit the usual behavior than long wavelength modes. Yep.
The waveguides in EMM have similar equations, and thinking the infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs that you put on, is that really similar to kind of putting it in a waveguide?
Well, in the case of the waveguide, you have that if the wavelengths are short enough, then the wave will fit into the waveguide and it's allowed to oscillate. However, if you have a waveguide of a finite size and you try to squeeze in a wavelength of a much longer wavelength, then it just can't. It is sort of forbidden and it will tunnel into it, but it will be exponentially attenuated. And you're right, that is a very similar phenomenon. It's not actually the physics that's happening here, but mathematically, yes, it's very similar. That if you have that motion is allowed, you have the oscillatory behavior, but if the wavelength is too big, it might just be suppressed. Yep. Just one difference, though. Here, It's not going to be suppressed, it's going to be the opposite. It's going to be that the long wavelengths will actually, because of this phenomenon, actually you will have this exponential increase rather than decrease. You will have actually both, but the decreasing part will not matter much, and the large part will be important.
Mm-hmm. In an expanding universe, the wavelength would expand with the universe.
Yes, exactly. And the wavelength expands. But keep in mind that the value of k stays the same.
For a fixed wave, k stays the same.
We introduce co-moving coordinates because the wavelength expands.
Well, we don't have to. But if we don't,
then we always are stuck with a partial differential equation because the modes will interact with each other. Having introduced the co-moving coordinates and then the co-moving momentum allowed us to get to this differential equation, which is an ordinary differential equation. It has its one differential equation for time for every k, but the different k's don't mix. In other coordinate systems, they would mix. So just a moment, you know, what does the k really mean? If you have a wave, if you look at a particular wave, over time, its wavelength will be stretched. But its k value will stay the same. The co-moving momentum will stay the same. Now, keep in mind that longer wavelengths waves have a smaller momentum than short wavelengths waves. Right? Short wavelengths is high momentum, high energy. And long wavelengths is low momentum. So even though the k value stays the same because of our choice of coordinate system, since the waves are expanding, they are reducing their physical momentum. So the relationship between the co-moving momentum and the physical momentum is non-trivial. And you can convince yourself by just going through the Fourier transform that you will pick up a factor of 1 over a as the Fourier transform a k variable. So that means that the physical momentum is the co-moving momentum divided by a. It's just undoing what we did in position space, where we said that the physical distance is the co-moving distance times a. For the momentum, it's just 1 over that. So we have that the physical momentum is the co-moving momentum divided by a. So just keep that in mind, that a fixed co-moving momentum doesn't mean a fixed physical momentum. It changes over time as the universe is expanding. All right, so this is the Klein-Gordon equation. And here's the frequency. A frequency can become negative, we said that. Now, here are some exercises. Show that the hermeticity condition is this. Really, I asked you to show that before already, many lectures ago, at the very beginning, when we first did Fourier transform. Remember there, we discussed already that if you have a self-adjoint operator valued field and you Fourier transform it, then the Fourier transform variable will obey this condition. And I'm just asking you to check this to see that no factor of A or something like that could get into the way. Similarly, with the canonically conjugate momentum field, also is, it is in position space self-adjoint operator value because it's simply scale factor times the phi, and the phi is self-adjoint operator value. Similarly, it, when it's Fourier transformed, has this property that putting the Hermitian conjugation on it is putting a minus sign on the index. Then also, please check that the canonical commutation relations between the chi and the phi are these, where I hope you remember the similarity to what we had before when we did it in Minkowski space for the phi field. You see that there's this little bit of a mismatch here. As we discussed before, the canonical commutation relation between the chi and the phi is not I delta of k minus k prime, which would mean that this thing peaks when k is equal to k prime. No, this thing peaks when k is equal to minus k prime. Just have to be a little careful there. But if you put the Hermitian conjugation on this, you see that this is what it is. Strictly speaking, what this means is that the canonically conjugate variable to the Fourier transform of chi is not pi, but is pi omega. All from rate. So now, in order to solve the equations of motion, parametricity condition, and the canonical commutation relations for chi, we make this ansatz, which is a special case of the general ansatz that we discussed before. We have some mode function multiplying a initialization operator plus the complex conjugate multiplying a creation operator. There is a k here and a minus k. It arises automatically because of the hermeticity condition, right? We need to have this. So therefore, once we Fourier transform, we have this expansion here. I'd like you to check as an exercise what the mode functions uk of eta and x are in terms of those mode functions vk of eta. Okay? Remember that our ansatz in position space that we discussed in full generality was that phi hat of, we wrote t and x is equal to a sum or an integral, it doesn't really matter. And then we had u, k, let's say, make it sum, u, k of t and x, a, k plus u star k, t and x, a dagger k. So please try to identify what the uk are. This is the answer that we work with. Not hard. All you have to do is just Fourier transform this thing to get the chi hat of t and x, and then divided by 1 over a, and you get the phi. Okay? And you will see that this ansatz is really matching that ansatz. Even though there's a k and there's a minus k over here, and here you have a k and a k over there, it all works out nicely. Just plug things in. In the Fourier transform, you may want to change integration variable from k to minus k in order to match this to that. Okay, so now the ansatz A here. And keep in mind that we will now work with this ansatz all the time. We will not go back to that ansatz. I mean, this is just a special case, of course, but we will work with it in this form, because that's going to be much more convenient in cosmology. It's much more convenient to work in Fourier space than it is to work in position space. Okay, so let's see. With this ansatz, we need to solve hermeticity, equation of motion, and canonical commutation relations. The hermeticity condition is obvious, right? By this ansatz, it's automatically fulfilled. The equation of motion is also going to be fulfilled as long as the vk of eta are each solving the equation of motion, are each solving the Van Gordon equation as complex number valued function. See, if this is a complex number valued function that obeys the Van Gordon equation, then its complex conjugate is doing the same. And since these guys are just constant, the whole thing here is going to obey the Van Gordon equation. So the Klein-Gordon equation that the V have to obey is this. I'm just writing it down again. We had it up there. We call this equation M. And thirdly, we have to obey the canonical commutation relations. Now, for that purpose, we had, and I restated that equation at the beginning of this lecture today, we had a complicated equation, the one that amounted to a resolution of the identity. Now, it turns out that because we succeeded in decoupling the various degrees of freedom, because we now have an independent equation of motion for each k, we also have independent commutation relations for each k. And therefore, this condition that ensures that the canonical commutation relations between phi and pi hold becomes now one simple condition for each k. We don't have to sum over stuff anymore. That's much simpler. The equation of the canonical commutation relations between phi and pi, or more precisely between in the new variables now, between pi and its canonically conjugate field, are obeyed if and only if that equation holds. It's not hard to check, but I asked you to try that. Prove that proposition, that the equations, that the canonical commutation relations implied this, and I implied by that. And the second part of the exercise is this. Assume that that some vk of eta are a solution of the equations of Mohn, of the Klein-Gordon equation. Then verify that if the vk also obey that equation at one time, they will obey the equation automatically at all times. We showed that this is the case in full generality before. But now, please try it out for this special case. Not difficult. All you do is differentiate to the left-hand side with respect to time, and prove that the left-hand side doesn't change. Prove that the derivative vanishes. I'm already giving away all the strategy. See, if you differentiate that thing, what are you going to get? You're going to get second derivatives. You're going to get first derivatives. The terms with the first derivatives are going to go away. The terms with the second derivative, you can use the Klein-Gordon equation for. And then, you know, just plug stuff in and see how it all works out. So prove that if this equation holds at one time, then it will hold at all time, assuming that the V is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Very important finding here, very, very important. Because it translates into the statement that as long as we ensure that the canonical commutation relations hold at one time, they will hold always. And remember that this is very significant, because this is what ensures the unitarity of the time evolution. This is what ensures that probabilities will always, if they sum up to one now, they will always sum up to one. It's a very important property. By the way, this expression here is called the Wronskian of the differential equation that is the Klein-Gordon equation. So if you are familiar with the theory of differential equations, ordinary differential equations, then you may recognize this expression. OK, so what is our conclusion so far? In order to obtain the solution, the time and space dependent solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, we do the following. First, we find for each mode k a solution vk of eta to the equation of motion. In principle, we can do this even numerically with very reliable precision. And that's because it's just an ordinary differential equation. It just depends on time. That's not hard to do. So all we have to solve here is for a solution to a classical harmonic oscillator, which has the only non-triviality that it has a time-dependent frequency. The mass term is time-dependent. And the frequency may even turn imaginary. But apart from that, it's just a matter of solving for the harmonic oscillator. For each mode k, so we get for each mode k a vk of eta. Then, once we have solutions to the Klein-Gordon equations, we know that we can build a phi hat that will also obey the Klein-Gordon equation. And it will also be Hermitian by construction. But we still have to make sure that the commutation relations hold. For that purpose, we only have to make sure that the Wronskian condition up there, this one, we only have to make sure that this Wronskian condition holds at one point in time. Because, as you show in your exercise, then it will hold at all time. And as we've shown in full generality before. And what we would have to do for this? Nothing in particular, nothing difficult in particular, because assume you have a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Then let's just plug it into this Wronskian condition. If it's a complex valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then the right-hand side of this expression, if you plug in our arbitrary solution to the Klein-Gordon equation that you may have found, you plug it in here on the left-hand side, and the right-hand side is going to be an imaginary number, automatically. Why is that? It's because this thing is the complex conjugate of that. Okay? See? If you take the complex conjugate of this product, it is that. So therefore, this is really the imaginary part of this. Okay? And therefore, whatever solution to the Klein-Gordon equation you plug in here, you always get something imaginary on the right-hand side. Cannot be avoided. Except if your solution is real valued. If it's real valued, then this is the same as that, which is to say the imaginary part is zero and the right-hand side is zero. In that case, you're lost. You can't do it with a real valued solution to the harmonic oscillator. It's got to be a complex valued solution, okay? But if you have a complex valued solution, plug it in there and you will find it's something like, I don't know, 27.5i. That's not good enough. So all we do is we simply rescale that solution so that when you plug it in now, you get 2 times i. And there we go. We found the solution. So we only may have to rescale the solution. You can do it with any complex valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. All right, so this was point B. Make sure that the solution obeys the Wronskian condition, if need be, by multiplying with a constant. But then we can build the basis in the Hilbert space, because we have our ansatz has succeeded. We found mode functions V, and we have creation annihilation operators A and A dagger. So we can build the basis now in the Hilbert space.
The freedom of choice for the real part of that function, then. Is that of any consequence?
No, it's not. It's only one real condition here. This is just one real condition, because it's imaginary part of this is 2i. It's just one real condition.
No, but the real part of that is
yeah, it doesn't matter. That's right. It doesn't matter what you choose for the real part of that. You have a huge ambiguity in the choice of the V. And we will discuss how much ambiguity there is going to be. We can already anticipate it, actually. You see, the Klein-Gordon equation is second order in time. It's now just an ordinary differential equation, second order in time, which means that the solution space has 2 dimensions. We're working with complex valued solutions, so the solution space has 2 complex dimensions, 2-dimensional as a complex vector space. That is the same as saying it's 4-dimensional as a real vector space, the real vector space. But our solutions have to obey the Wronskian condition, which is one real value condition, and in the imaginary part of this stuff is 2. So ultimately, we are left with concluding, at least so far, that for every mode k, there's going to be a three parameter family of mode functions that obey the Klein-Gordon equation and obey the Wronskian condition. Actually, another parameter goes away because of overall prefact in front of the mode function of the phase, the arbitrary phase in front of it also will not matter physically. So we will be ending up with only a 2-parameter family of mode functions that obey the Klein-Gordon equation, that obey the Wronskian condition, and have arbitrary phases as prefactors. All right. So once we've gone through our ansatz, found the mode functions that obey the Klein-Gordon equation and the Wronskian condition,
we can build the basis in the Hilbert space from that solution. But then what about the choice? For each choice of such mode functions, and as we just discussed, there is for each mode a two-parameter family of choices. So either we choose the vk of eta, or we choose vk tilde of eta, which is just another set of mode functions that obey all the conditions. We get different bases. In the first case, if we choose to express our solution, phi hat of x, using those guys, then they come along with a and a Lego operators, which give us this basis of the Hilbert space. But then if we choose other mode functions, then they give us that basis of the same Hilbert space. Again, it's the same Hilbert space because we assume that Stirling von Neumann applies, and that's because we assume that infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs can be used. In principle, any basis is good as any other in a Hilbert space. But you will often find it convenient to use a particular basis. Let's say a basis of vectors 0 and a vector squared and so on on the 0 vector. You will often find it useful to find a particular to use a particular basis that comes with a particular set of mode functions. There's going to be a preferred choice. For example, at the initial time, we may want to choose a particular basis coming along with a particular set of mode functions. And at a later time, we may want to choose a different basis for the Hilbert space. Because, well, why would we want to do this? Well, because it often happens that initially, let's say the cosmological evolution, initially, we may know which state the quantum field is in. Let's call this state, omega, whatnot. It's in some state that it's in. And if we know what that state is, which Hilbert space vector that is, and then it makes sense, it's convenient to choose mode functions such that their vector 0 is that vector, is that vacuum state that the field is in. And then later on, after a lot of evolution has happened, we may be able to identify which vector Hilbert space is the vector vector. Then again, it may be useful or convenient to use mode functions such that their vector 0 is what is the vacuum vector there. Very similar to how we handled the calculation of the driven harmonic oscillator, where we had it in ground state 0 and out ground state 0. So we may choose a set of mode functions whose vector 0 happens to be the vacuum state one time, and we may choose another set of mode functions whose vector 0 tilde happens to be the vacuum state at another. Remember though that we work in the Heisenberg picture, which means that whatever state the system is in, it stays in that state. So even though things change, the physics changes, the system stays in the same vector in the Hilbert space. It's just that each vector in the Hilbert space changes meaning over time. The vector that describes the vacuum at an early time may not describe the vacuum at the late time. Oh, and just to clarify this again, what do we mean by vacuum now? By vacuum, we mean the state without particles. Okay? It's not necessarily the same as the ground state of the system, the lowest energy state. We have to free ourselves from that. Those two things have different meanings. Ground state is lowest energy state. The vacuum state is no particle state. Now, we already anticipated that. Let's ask, how many possible choices of mode functions are there? Well, as we said, we can consider each mode k separately, because each mode k has its own equation of motion that's independent of the others, and it has its own commutation relationship and a physical condition. as we discussed already. The solution space to the Klein-Gordon equation has two complex dimensions, because it's going up to second time derivatives. The solutions are specified by specifying either two boundary conditions or one boundary condition and its derivative. So we have two complex dimensional solution space. But also, if Vk is a complex valued solution, then clearly, if Vk is a solution to this equation function, then Vk star is also a solution to it. And that's simply because this stuff is all real. Okay? The real differential equation, therefore, if Vk is a complex valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, Vk star is also. But this is very convenient, because it means that the two guys form a basis in the solution space. Except if Vk is purely real, or it's purely imaginary, then it's just proportional to its complex conjugate. But in general, it won't be. And so in general, if this is an arbitrary complex valued solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, then its complex conjugate is also going to be a solution, and is one that's linearly independent of this one. Therefore, the two of them together span that solution space. So you get every arbitrary solution to the every arbitrary complex valued solution to the Klein-Gordon equation as a complex number times this plus a complex number times that. Now you may wonder, well, don't we have to keep track now of whether or not V is purely real, for example, in which case, if it's a real value solution, then its complex conjugate is itself, and therefore the two don't span the entire function space. No, we don't have to keep track of that.
And that's because we will be dealing only with mode functions that we will be interested only in mode functions that obey all criteria, that obey not just the Klein-Gordon equation, but also the Wronskian condition. And remember that the Wronskian condition required that the V is not purely real or purely imaginary. Okay? So it's not a restriction. We can say in full generality that for all V, for all mode functions, and by mode function I mean solution to the Klein-Gordon equation and the Wronskian condition, for all mode functions, it is true that the mode function and its complex conjugate together span the complex solution space to the Klein-Gordon equation. So this is to say that there is a bit of order in this big solution space, namely any arbitrary solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, sorry, any arbitrary mode function, which means solution to the Klein-Gordon equation and Wronskian condition, is a linear combination of a given mode function and its complicate and its complex conjugate. So this means that even though there's a huge arbitrariness in choosing our mode functions, we know that if V is a mode function and V tilde is a mode function, then there must exist complex numbers alpha and beta such that this equation holds, simply because this is an element of the same solution space, then the V and the V star and the V and the V star are a basis in that solution space. Those numbers alpha and k are going to play a huge role in what comes next in this course, because beta is going to be quantifying the amount of particle production, and it's going to be quantifying the size or the amplitude of quantum fluctuations later on. It's not obvious here now, but you will see. So as we discussed before, the actual dimensionality in the space of mode functions, which is not a linear space, is 3. You see, if you have a mode function and another mode function, the sum of the two is not a mode function. Remember.
Right? So if you have a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation and another solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, yeah, the sum of them is also a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. But a mode function, we require to obey an additional condition. A mode function is obeying the Klein-Gordon equation and the Wronskian condition. But the Wronskian condition fixes its overall length of the vector, right? If you have a mode function multiplied with 7, it's no longer a mode function. It still obeys the Klein-Gordon equation, all right, but it's not going to obey the Wronskian condition. So the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation has four real dimensions, and it's a vector space, a four-dimensional vector space. The space of the set of mode functions, however, it's a three-dimensional submanifold of this four-dimensional space, and it's not itself linear. Okay, that's just what I'm saying here. Okay, so now here's a proposition that I guess you're expecting that already. I'm expecting you to prove it. Proposition is this. Assume that vk is a mode function. So it obeys not only the Klein-Gordon equation, but also w, the Wronskian condition, the condition that ensures the validity of the commutation relation. Well, then the another function that solves the Klein-Gordon equation, v tilde, which is defined through such a linear combination, also obeys the Wronskian condition if the coefficients alpha and beta obey that. So remember, if vk is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, v tilde, which is simply a linear combination of v and v star, is certainly also going to be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. The question is, will it qualify also as a mode function? So if v obeys the Wronskian condition, then for sure v star is obeying the Wronskian condition. But the linear combination is not guaranteed to hold to obey the Wronskian condition because the Wronskian condition is nonlinear. Remember, it has v star, and then on the right hand side, it just has 2i. This thing is not linear. So we ask, under which conditions for alpha and beta do mode functions v tilde also obey the Wronskian condition? Not hard to check. You just put this thing into the Wronskian condition. Assume that v and v tilde are obeying the Wronskian condition already. And then check what alpha and beta have to obey for v tilde to also obey the Wronskian condition. And you find this is the condition on alpha and beta. This is the equation which cuts down the four real dimensional vector space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation to a three-dimensional manifold of mode functions. Because this is one real condition. Okay? Alpha has two real parameters, namely a real part and an imaginary part. Beta has a real part and an imaginary part. So you have here, in the linear combination, four real numbers to specify to choose the v tilde. That's one real condition, and that gets rid of one dimension in those four. So you can think of it as a sort of a hyperbola in four dimensions. Okay, so what do we have? In this case, when both v and v tilde are mode functions, and then we can write our field chi both in this way or in that way. You can either express it in terms of the mode functions v and their a and a dagger operators, or in terms of the mode functions v tilde and their a tilde and a tilde dagger operators. And we can choose any other mode functions and their creation and annihilation operators as well. So this equation here, p, which says that this way of writing the solution is the same as that way of writing a solution, which is to say that they only differ by a choice of basis. Which is to say that the basis that we construct using the A and the A dagger is spanning the same space as the basis that we get when we use the A tildes and the A tilde daggers to span the space. this equation now is going to be very useful. Remember equation P, which says that we can express the solution in this way or using the other mode functions, and this equation B as well, which is expressing the mode functions V tilde in terms of the mode functions V and V star. Remember those two equations. So the transformations which get us from the choice of basis that comes with the untilded mode functions to a choice of basis that comes with tilded mode functions, that choice, that change of basis in the Hilbert space is called the Bogle-Yubov transformation. It comes up also in condensed matter physics and all over cosmology. Very important concept. And in fact, we already encountered one when we studied the driven harmonic oscillator. Because there we had the zero in and the zero out. They were nothing but an example of that general phenomenon. So we have two tasks now. First, let's make this Bogle-Yubov transformation explicit. How do we go from the Hilbert basis that comes with the A-nil dagger to the Hilbert basis that comes with the A tilde and A tilde dagger? And then secondly, once we can move freely between one basis and the other, between using one set of mode functions and using another set of mode functions, when we can do that freely, move between them, then let's find out which choice is convenient when. Which choice of mode function, which choice of A and A dagger operators, which choice of basis is convenient when.
Yeah?
Let's keep the two concepts separate. There's the ground state, which is the state of low energy, the Bacon state, defined as the state without particles. And in Kosky states, they happen to be the same, but in general, they're not. Okay, so let us study Bogle-Yubov transformations of Hilbert spaces. How can we express
this basis of vectors? Remember, they are all orthogonal to another, and they are normalized because of these three factors of 1 over square root of n factorial. How can we express this basis in terms of that basis, and vice versa? Now, remember the two equations that I singled out up there, B and P? One equation was P, saying that you can express the field this way or that way. And the equation B said that the tilted mode functions have to be a linear combination of the untilted mode functions. From those two equations, I'm asking you to prove that the A are this linear combination of the A tilde and A tilde dagger. And of course, you can similarly write down an equation that relates the, that expresses the A tilde in terms of the A and the A dagger. It's not difficult. Just put the two equations together and compare coefficients. But please do try it, because it will help you memorize and understand what's going on. This equation is very important, because it is the link. It is going to provide the link between the two bases here. Remember that this vector is defined as the vector that is annihilated by the A operators. That is the vector that's annihilated by the A tilde operators. This relates the A to the A tilde operators. Remember what we had in the driven harmonic oscillator case. There we had that A out was A in plus J naught. And from that, we were able to relate the basis that we constructed using this to the basis that we constructed using that. And we found that was that what was the zero in vector
actually in the out basis looked like a coherent state with excitations present. And here we have a slightly more complicated thing where we have that A is a linear combination of the A tilde and not just a constant, what would be the J naught, that is what we had before, but actually beta times A tilde dagger of minus K. Okay, so it's really relating here the K modes to the minus K mode. I mean, really, they're not independent, the K and the minus K, but it's relating the K and the minus K. It's a bit more complicated than just than the case of the driven harmonic oscillator. Okay. So remember that when we built the basis that comes with the untilted quantities, then the key equation is the identification of that vector here as the vector that's annihilated by the A. Well, we can express the A now in terms of those quantities. So therefore, this equation now takes that form. See, this is linking the untilted quantities to the tilted quantities. So what we have to do now is write down an ansatz for this untilded vector zero such that this equation holds. Well, it may be hard to do this from scratch. If you want to do it from scratch, make this kind of ansatz. It's got to be true. We can try an ansatz where this vector zero, the untilted one, is this vector here in terms of the tilted quantities. It's got to be something complicated acting on the tilted zero. Right? Simply because this is some vector in the Hilbert space spanned by that sort of thing. And this is a little bit restricting how that state might look like. So you can do this. You can try to solve that equation with this ansatz for the vector zero. But it's easier if I give you the solution and you just verify that it's true. Okay, I won't make you suffer too much. So this is how it looks like. Please check that it does, really, by just plugging that expression up into that equation, right? So the claim is that if you plug this lengthy expression into this equation here for that, this actually comes out to be zero. Well, how would you prove this? Have this stuff multiplying all of this. Well, you have to simplify these things. You have to show that really they're on the right hand side. The only chance you have is to make use of the fact that A doesn't commute with the A, the A tilde doesn't commute with the A tilde daggers. And in particular, it doesn't commute with the A tilde dagger K. It does commute with the one with the minus K. So all you have to do is commute this thing through that. You see, if you use the commutation relation to put the A to the right of this bracket, then the resulting term has an A over here. I mean, it has an A tilde over here, and that term goes away. The question is, what does it pick up when you commute this thing through that? And remember what we had before. There's a simple observation. While A dagger minus A dagger A is 1, you also have that dx x minus x dx is 1. Just apply it to some arbitrary A. Okay? This tells you what these commutation relations really do. If you have an A, and you commute it, for example, through an e to the power of alpha A dagger, it should be alpha e to the power A dagger, because it acts as differentiation. And here, this alpha is the A tilde dagger A minus K and all that prefactor here, because all of this is commuting with the A tilde. Okay, please play around with this and convince yourself that this is how it works. Basically, you get down all of this stuff here because it's like a differentiation. And this term here, you can pull to the right of it without any problem because this is a dagger that commutes with those. And then that term that you get when you have this thing to the right, and the term that you get when you commute this through here and get the derivative down, those two terms just have to cancel. And they will. So as a hint, make use of this fact, namely that the commutator between A and e to the power lambda A dagger is lambda e to the power of lambda A dagger. One thing to keep in mind here is that the solution has A tilde dagger K and A tilde dagger minus K always occurring together. Remember what such an exponential is. I mean, this is just the normalization prefactor, right? But what is such an exponential really? It's a power series, right? Remember that e to the power of b sum over n, and then you have b to the power n over n factorial. This is really how this thing is to be understood, namely as this, as this series here. So what we have is that the higher and higher powers of b, b is all of this. So we have higher and higher powers of these pairs. But what is that? If you take this expression to the fifth power and act with it on that, it means you're describing five pairs of particles. Okay, because this is a particle, this is a pair of particles, one moving in the k direction, one moving in the minus k direction. And if you take the fifth power of that, you get five such pairs. So this whole thing here is, if for the moment we adopt a particle interpretation, which we don't know yet whether that's legal, because we haven't identified this as the no particle state. This looks as if it's a state which has a lot of particles present. There's a probability for finding any number of particles, but it's always equal number moving to the right, to the left. They can move in all arbitrary directions because you go over all k, but you always have pairs. So let us now interpret this equation t physically. Let us assume that the vector 0 and the vector 0 tilde are those Hilbert space vectors which happen to be the vacuum state vectors at times eta 1 and eta 2 respectively. So let's say at early times, this vector happens to be the no particle vector. And at late times, this vector happens to be the no particle vector. How we identify that, well, we will find out later. But let's just assume it is so, that at early times, this is the no particle vector in the Hilbert space, and that happens to be the no particle vector in the Hilbert space. Then what? Well, then assume that at the early time eta 1, the quantum field theory is in the state omega, which happens to be the no particle state. Then obviously it's convenient to choose the mode functions such that the vector 0 that comes with the mode functions that we choose happens to be the state of the system. In other words, let us assume that the quantum field starts out in a no particle state. So let us assume the quantum field starts out in a no particle state, and we have chosen mode functions such that the corresponding vector 0 is that no particle state. Then at the later time eta 2, the quantum field is still in this state, obviously, because you work in Heisenberg picture. But the vacuum state, the no particle state, by then is some other vector in the Hilbert space. And that other vector might be the zero tilde vector. In fact, we will choose mode functions in such a way that the corresponding zero tilde vector happens to be the no particle state.
Functions will always exist?
Yes. Yes.
By the general arguments that we developed before. Always have to be. There's a uniqueness there. We can always change bases so that we get. So then if that's the situation,
then we can look back at this equation here. And we see the following. This is the vector in the Hilbert space, which at early times described the no particle state. That is the vector in the Hilbert space, which at late times describes the no particle state. This is this, not only the state, is not only that vector in the Hilbert space, which described at early times the no particle state. By assumption, by physical assumption, this is also the state of the quantum field. In cosmology, we will have reason to assume that the quantum field starts out in a no particle state. So this is also the state of the field, actually, at early times and at all times. And now what we see is that this state, the state of the quantum field, at early times and at late times, always, it's a Heisenberg picture, that state, at late times, is this complicated expression. I mean, it's always this complicated expression, but at late times, the interpretation is that this is the no particle state, but this whole thing is a multiparticle state. So therefore, at late times, we will conclude that even though the universe started out in a no particle state, this state has become a multiparticle state later on. And it has become a state in which pairs of particles are present. And this observation that they always arise in pairs has led people to suggest that the intuition might be that quantum fluctuations are being stretched apart by the expansion of the universe, such that particle-antiparticle pairs are being created, one particle going this way, one particle going the other way. You may wonder, well, what about antiparticles here? The thing is that for a real valued scalar field, which when quantized becomes a self-adjoint operator valued scalar field, the notion of particle and antiparticle is the same, actually. But if we had introduced complex valued fields, then they would be charged. And then the charge would be opposite, and it would show up here. Then we would have really, let's say, electrons, positrons being created in this way. Photons, too, you know, are described by real valued fields, so they are their own antiparticles. But quarks, electrons, and so on are not. But I just wanted to mention this, that this gives rise to the idea that you have, the fact that particles are being created in pairs is often intuitively interpreted as ripping them out of whatever. I don't think that the intuition is worth very much, but this is where it comes from.
By the momentum, the sign.
Well, they can go in all directions, all of them. Particles and antiparticles differ in their quantum numbers, such as charge.
But how do we know that antiparticles are also being created?
Well, we don't in this case, because we don't distinguish particles from antiparticles. I'm just saying that you will find this intuition mentioned often. And that comes from doing the calculation in situations where particles are different from antiparticles. In which case you will have that there is a particle created and an antiparticle created. If you did the same calculations for electrons and positrons, you will find that an electron and a positron pair are being created.
How do you know that electron and a positron pair from the expression?
Well, because they have different creation operators. There will be a creation operator for an electron and a creation operator for
That's what I was asking. That's what I was saying earlier, but you said that we are not sure.
that's what it means. But in this case, it's the same.
Right. Anything else there? Nope.
Right. Okay. So next we will have to identify those vacuum states. How do we find out what is really the no particle state? Okay, see you on Thursday.